Our next case this morning is in the matter of AG Financial Service Center. Mr. Whitehurst.
Thank you, sir. May it please the court. Tuesday, the appellees filed a motion to dismiss on jurisdictional grounds. I have not had an opportunity to do much research on that. I would hope the court would give me some additional time to respond to that.
No, this is the time to respond.
Okay. The motion to dismiss relies on the Lopez case, which Judge Posner decided, and it was based on the argument that when a remand is ordered other than on a technicality, then the remand does not make the order a final order. And therefore, any notice of appeal from the decision of the court doesn't give this court jurisdiction on it. Now, the court cases are a little bit unclear about what has to happen.
What did happen?
What did happen in this case?
Yeah, what did happen?
In this case, the Judge Barker affirmed in all respects.
No. What happened in the bankruptcy court on remand?
The bankruptcy court essentially inserted the language that Judge
Essentially?
Barker. Yes, sir. Actually.
And what does essentially cover? What did it do other than what the district court said?
Nothing.
Did it do it essentially or did it do it exactly?
It deleted paragraph 14 of the plan and replaced it with the language exactly verbatim that the judge recommended. And so that gets into the question about whether or not this was a ministerial type of activity under the Lopez decision, or whether that was some discretionary activity under the argument that the order would not be final because the judge had the opportunity to do something different. I think clearly in the context of this case you can see that it is much more like the ministerial function suggested in the Lopez case, which was calculating interest and that sort of thing.
Was that the only option the bankruptcy court had on remand?
Well, obviously the bankruptcy court could have had the option to even throw out the whole confirmation order, I would assume, although I don't think that was likely or expected. And Judge Barker, in her opinion, said, this is just a minor technicality that needed to be fixed. And so, it wasn't a minor technicality because obviously it was something that exceeded the jurisdiction of the court. And she just suggested in her order language that would fix it to the satisfaction of the jurisdictional requirements. And the judge did that. One other thing that's kind of interesting, and I haven't had the time to check the filing stamps on it, but the question then becomes, when the judge in the bankruptcy court does that, when then does the order become final as far as the right to appeal to this court? And the reason I say that's very interesting is the bankruptcy judge signed his order on the very same day that the notice of appeal to this court was filed. And I think that's in the record on the case. So then the question thus becomes, does that make the bankruptcy order final? The district court order final when the...
No. That's the one thing that's impossible. Either the district court order was final or it wasn't. What the bankruptcy judge did later doesn't affect the finality of the district court's order. If the district court's order was non-final, you then file a notice of appeal from the bankruptcy judge's new confirmation.
Well,
to the district court, and then you appeal from the district court to here, and that's not a well, that's just yes.
If I could disagree with Your Honor, actually, the judge did not...
Quibbling about obvious points doesn't really help.
Yes, I'm sorry. What the bankruptcy court did in this case was to take out one paragraph and put in the language, but it did not say anything else about reaffirming the confirmation order. It didn't say anything, and there was nothing for me to...
Doesn't make any difference. Now, were there... Let me come back to Judge Sykes' question. Mm-hmm. Were there any other serious options that the bankruptcy judge could have pursued?
Well, there was possible options, not necessarily likely options, in like... I said, I mean, even the bankruptcy judge could have said, well, I don't like having to put this language in here, so I'm going to just throw the whole plan out. I mean, it could have been, you know, that the bankruptcy court obviously had that much authority. Nobody really expected that.
You think that would have been a legally tenable position? Right. I'm not asking whether there were options like the bankruptcy judge could have learned to go paragliding or... Mm-hmm. Right, the world is full of things, but how many legally correct things could the bankruptcy judge have done?
Well, the only reason I use that extreme example is this.
Had the bankruptcy judge thrown out the plan on that account, it would have been summarily reversed, right? It's not a legally correct thing the bankruptcy judge could have done. That's why I'm trying to figure out what would have been proper things to do.
I think while that's extreme, but, you know, it's certainly... I wouldn't say that was improper, but, you know, it could have happened, but I think everybody expected all the bankruptcy judge had to do was go back and fix it like the district judge said. One other thing, and you were talking about what the correct procedure would be as far as the bankruptcy court's order making the order final. I didn't really have any dispute with the bankruptcy court's order that was entered this year on remand. In fact, that's what we asked for. That was one of our objections, and there would be no reason for me to appeal that order. But the real question then becomes, does the bankruptcy court have a duty to make a return on remand? And I'm just kind of going by how our appellate procedures are where I come from. Normally, if a case is remanded to a lower court, then the lower court would make a return on remand.
I think learning something about federal practice would have been helpful to you.
Yes, sir. Well, I'll try to weigh myself through it, Your Honor. But I would assume that there would need to be some kind of return to remand.
No. As I said, learning something about federal practice would have been helpful to you.
Mm-hmm. All right. Your Honor, if that... is the case that I'm kind of caught between a rock and a hard place. If the bankruptcy judge's order does not make the judge's order final.
Well, I think we've probably exhausted this.
Okay.
I'm going to, and perhaps Judge Sykes will also ask your adversary this question, what else could the bankruptcy judge have done? But
okay.
Why don't you proceed with the discussion?
Well, and I appreciate that. There are really three issues that I want to try to address. I realize I've raised a lot of arguments in the case, in the briefs, and I certainly can't do it all in the time frame we're looking at. I want to talk about the estimation order. I want to talk about the injunction, and particularly as it relates to Article 3, and I want to talk about the plan and the unfair discrimination. And if the court has some other topics that they're interested in, please feel free to pursue it. But let me start with the estimation order. Because I think it's important that really all the other issues in the case deal with the estimation order. And the purpose of estimation is to allow claims. That's just kind of a word of art in the bankruptcy court, is allowance of claims. In other words, these were unliquidated claims and they needed to be liquidated. And even though the debtor and American General disagreed, obviously in the context of a case like this, estimation was the most appropriate way to do this. But in liquidating these claims and allowing these claims, it really has nothing to do with whether the claims are ultimately going to be paid or not, and that's particularly true as far as the issue of punitive damages is concerned. I think all parties agree that in estimating claims, that the estimation will be based on the underlying principles of law, substantive law, that would support or deny the claim. Now, as you know, Judge Lortz determined to allow all of the Class 8 claims, of which some of my clients are members. And in doing this, he basically rejected the argument that the debtor made that there were defenses to the claims like statutes of limitations and the like. And, of course, there was no appeal from that finding in the estimation of by the debtor, American General. The two aspects of the award that I think are important deal, number one, with the punitive damage award, or rather disallowance of the punitive damage award. And again, I think this goes back to the misinterpretation of Judge Lorch's purpose in the estimation as far as allowing claims as opposed to whether the claims would ultimately be paid down the road. Judge Lorch, in the estimation, said that the reason he would disallow punitive damages was to ensure fair and equal distribution. Now, if you'll look at Section 726 of the Code...
Let's get at this in a different way. Is it your position that your clients have suffered actual damages exceeding $5,500?
Yes, sir.
Doesn't this plan make a provision for a fact-finding proceeding to explore that possibility?
Yes, sir, it does.
So why are we here? If your clients actually suffered more than $5,500 in actual damages, you can get an adjudication of that. You don't have to rest with any estimation.
Well,
you can take $5,500 or some larger amount from an actual adjudication. What's the problem?
Well, the reason we're here is that by accepting the award, either way, my clients could potentially be accepting a release or a satisfaction.
Well, that's true. It's like an appraisal proceeding in corporate law. If you take the offer, you can't play for more. But if you turn down the offer, you can ask for more. And there's a provision in this plan to do that. That's what puzzles me.
Well, and the second reason is this, Your Honor. The court, in its estimation order, made the specific finding that the alternate provision for getting an award was unfair. Let me see if I can actually find that language. He said, the disparity in bargaining power put the Class 8 claimant at a sharp disadvantage in the claims resolution process. And that's exactly why he did the estimation. So the unfairness is that my clients and anybody else that wanted to pursue this claims resolution process would essentially be singled out from every other claim and be given disparate treatment by doing it.
I don't understand that.
Well, every other claim was resolved collectively.
Exactly. People who settle their claims don't ask for trials. You have not settled your claims, and under this plan, you're entitled to ask for adjudication.
Well,
that's not disparate treatment. It just says you get adjudication only if you haven't settled your claim.
Well, even then, we still don't have the right to get punitive damages under it.
Right, but that doesn't have anything to do with the trial. The district judge, bankruptcy judge, and the district judge held that as a matter of law, this is not a kind of claim on which punitive damages are available.
Well,
if you went to a jury, the jury would be so instructed. There would be no, right, whether punitive damages are available is a decision made by the court.
Right.
Initially. That has nothing to do with whether there's a jury trial or any other kind of proceeding.
But, that's why we appealed the estimation order, because of the judge's ruling that punitive damages would not be available. And again, that goes back to the argument that...
I must say, counsel, I did not find in your brief any substantive argument explaining why punitive damages should be available.
Well, punitive damages serve two purposes.
Let's start with the question, what body of law would apply, on your view?
Well... There are several, and this gets back to what claims were released. There were many, many claims that were essentially potential claims that were released. The judge looked at...
Please, Just tell me what body of law would apply on your view.
Well, for example, there were potential RICO claims that could be involved, potential fraud claims that could be involved, claims that would be...
All right, let's take the fraud claims. What body of law would apply on your view?
Well, in a fraud claim, Judge, anything that is generally considered willful or intentional can be the basis for an award.
Under what body of law?
Well,
we have 54 state legal systems and a federal legal system. That's 55 options.
That's right.
Which one would govern?
Well, generally, the fraud would be where the locus of the fraud was. For example, my clients were in Alabama, and it would be governed by the state law in Alabama that deals with fraud.
You think that's what the choice of law principles at Indiana would select? Your brief doesn't discuss any of this. I don't see how you could expect us to hold that punitive damages are available when we don't get to stage one of this analysis.
Well, I guess the only point I really want to make is that in other cases, particularly the Clayton Smith group, they were actually paid almost more than $25 million in punitive damages. These claims, Judge Lorch ruled, were all virtually similar or identical. And I hardly see how there could be a basis for awarding punitive damages for one group of claimants and not giving them to the other. I haven't really gotten very far on this, Judge, but I want to reserve some time for rebuttal if there's anything else we need to talk about.
Certainly, Mr. Whitehurst.
Thank you.
Ms. Yates.
Thank you, Your Honors. Marie Yates for Appley AGFI. And if I could start with Judge Sykes and Judge Easterbrook's question about what else could the bankruptcy court...
Do you agree that the bankruptcy judge did indeed enter exactly the language the district court put in her opinion?
I agree that he entered exactly the language that she suggested he may put in the opinion.
Okay.
And that's where...
And that leaves the question, what other options would have been legally tenable?
Exactly. Exactly, Your Honor. And that's why we filed the motion, because it seemed to us that there is at least a legal question here on whether this was a ministerial remand. Because she did not direct, Judge Barker did not direct Judge Lork, you will enter this particular language. She directed that he must revise the last sentence of paragraph 14 of the order so that it wouldn't be overbroad jurisdictionally. But the manner in which he did that, it seems to us, was within his jurisdiction and his authority, his discretion. And we suggest in our motion that, for example, he might have decided, okay, Judge Barker thinks his language is too broad, I'm just going to delete the sentence. And where would we be on the face of that order had Judge Lorch decided to simply delete the sentence? And that's why we believe that the court, that we wanted to put before the panel the question of whether this is really a ministerial remand, because if it is not, then there would not be jurisdiction over this confirmation order, and that's why we filed our motion.
It would have been better to have this, obviously, before you file any briefs.
Your Honor, you're absolutely right, and I want to stand here and fall on my sword on that. We should have caught this much earlier, and were it not a jurisdictional point, and had I not been concerned that one of you all would say, why didn't you raise this, I probably wouldn't have filed the motion.
Yeah.
But we felt compelled to file the motion.
And I must say, we very much appreciate it. It's always good when people are looking at this, even at the last minute, because we then look at it even at a later minute.
Yes, yes, sir. I knew you
so
would.
We certainly appreciate
and
it.
So if I could leave it with your honors, do you think this is ministerial or not, to make that determination? Because I don't think it's entirely clear. I think there's a perfectly legitimate argument that it's not ministerial. That's why we filed the motion. But the truth of the matter is, we believe that there are no legitimate appellate complaints that Mr. Whitehurst has put forward, and I'd very much like to address those if your honors would permit. The overarching principle from this circuit that starts with the Coke refining decision that is dispositive of most of Mr. Whitehurst's complaints is the principle that the alter ego claim against my client, AGFI, the parent of the debtor, is a cause of action that belongs to the debtor corporation. That comes from Coke refining, and it's beautifully explained by Judge Posner in Fogel versus Zell, where he says, why is this the case? The reason it's the case is that, as he puts it, the primary victim of the conduct that gives rise to the alter ego claim against the parent is the debtor corporation itself. And as he puts it, the claimants, the creditors against the debtor corporation, suffer only in the sense that they have a potential claim to assets of the debtor. and that's a claim that is shared in common among all the creditors of the debtor. That's why it's a derivative claim that belongs to the debtor and not a personal or direct claim that belongs to the individual claimants like Mr. Whitehurst's clients. That principle, Your Honor, answers almost every one of his complaints.
And how, if at all, are any direct claims implicated?
Indirect, you mean the direct claims? The direct claims, Your Honor, the direct claim, if there were such things, if there were a direct claim against my client, that's not released, it's not enjoined, Mr. Whitehurst can go sue on it right now. His problem is that the alter ego claim is not a direct claim. It's a derivative claim that belongs to the debtor. And because it belongs to the debtor, Your Honor, there's clearly bankruptcy court jurisdiction, because remember, my client, AGFI, is itself a creditor in the bankruptcy. So the debtor's alter ego claim against my client is a counterclaim by a debtor against a creditor. That's one of the items that's listed in core jurisdiction under 28 U.S.C. Section 157. So we're in the heartland of bankruptcy court jurisdiction here with respect to everything that Judge Lorch did, whether it was confirming the plan or the estimation order or the administrative order on sealing the matrix. So there just is not a jurisdictional problem. With respect to his complaint about the injunction enjoining third parties like his clients from suing AGFI on the alter ego claim, again, the fact that the alter ego claim belongs to the debtor under the settled law of this circuit that he's not complaining about, he doesn't challenge, that fact brings this case right under this court's decision in NRA Energy Co-op, where this court held that it was perfectly appropriate for a bankruptcy judge to enjoin third parties from pursuing a cause of action that belongs to the debtor that the debtor has released. That's exactly what's going on here. With respect to his complaint about the release, if you look at his own brief on page 25 of his brief, he quotes, for your honors, the relevant language out of the release that limits the release to causes of action that belong to the debtor. So the first thing the release says, and it is a lot of language, it's long, but it starts out by saying the causes of action that belong to the debtor are what's released, and the bankruptcy judge so found in finding number 113 that the release only released causes of action that belong to the debtor. And it's true that thereafter the release goes on to give a laundry list of what those causes of action might be. That, Your Honors, is exactly what this court suggested be done in NRA Energy Co-op. You put the broad principle of what's released, and then you follow it with the laundry list. That's why our lawyers wrote the release the way they did. They were trying to follow NRA Energy Co-op. So there's no problem on jurisdiction, there's no problem on the injunction, and there's no problem on the release. So if I could pass to Mr. Whitehurst's attack on the settlement and the plan, that's his next bundle of complaints. With respect to the settlement, the standard is this court's decision in NRA American Reserve. It's an abuse of discretion standard. Did bankruptcy Judge Lorch abuse his discretion in approving this settlement? Look at what my client paid and agreed to do, AGFI, who was the alleged alter ego, and as Judge Lorch pointed out, that was going to be a hotly disputed issue. Mr. Whitehurst referred to the Mississippi Chancery Court's decision that gave rise to that huge judgment. I want to make clear to Your Honors, my client, AGFI, was not a party to that lawsuit. My client was held by that chancery judge in Mississippi to be an alter ego, but we weren't there. We didn't have a chance to contest the issue, and we would have appealed it vigorously but for the settlement. So Judge Lorch in bankruptcy says, you know, this was going to be hotly contested, and yet here is the parent corporation, AGFI, agreeing to step up to the plate and fully fund any compensatory damages, not punitives. I'll admit my client said we're not going to agree to be on the hook for speculative or unlimited punitive damages, but we will fully fund any compensatory damages for all the claimants.
How much of that $167 million Mississippi judgment was punitive damages? Most of it was.
All but $500,000, Your Honor. It was almost all punitive damages. And it was on appeal to the Mississippi Supreme
Court.
That's
only with 27 plaintiffs or something?
Yes, Your Honor. And if you've been following what's been going on in Mississippi, the Supreme Court of Mississippi is greatly changing the direction of the law.
We're
in
always interested in what's going on.
Right, and so I think I'm from Mississippi. I am too, but in any event, Your Honor, the release and the settlement was an excellent deal for the creditors. We would contend that the debtor here, separately controlled by two independent directors and the president, Bettina White, who's a nationally known workout specialist, fully exercised and fulfilled her fiduciary duty of the debtor to all the creditors by getting what was a really good deal in this settlement. And look what Mr. Whitehurst's claimants got. Judge Easterbrook's already brought this out. They get a basket of benefits, $5,500 in cash or debt forgiveness, when the bankruptcy judge found that the average amount borrowed here was $3,000. $3,000, but they get $5,500. They get notice to the credit bureaus to remove any adverse credit effects. They get payment in cash of any tax, negative tax consequences from the settlement. And most importantly, as Judge Easterbrook pointed out, they are the only class in the plan, the only class that has the absolute right to opt out and say, no, I want to go to trial, I want to prove what my actual damages are. And my client, AGFI, said, you prove it, you get the finding, and we'll pay it. And we paid out $57 million toward the resolution to this. So there's just no contention, we think, Your Honor, that there could be an abuse of discretion on this settlement. That leads his contention that the plan was not proposed in good faith. Well, that's this court's decision in Ray Madison Hotel. You look at the plan itself. If this looks like a pretty good deal for these creditors, then you assume the plan was proposed in good faith. Then he complains about the classifications in the plan. Your Honor, that's this court's decision in Wabash Valley Power Association, where this court held that it's perfectly okay to have separate classifications if there are disparate legal rights among the different classes, and that's what we had here. As Judge Evans points out, we had one group that had a judgment. We had one group that was trial ready, could have gotten the automatic stay lifted and gone to trial and perhaps gotten another judgment. And look at Class 8. Class 8 was treated differently. They're the only ones that could opt out, but all the other classes voted to accept the plan. So if there's discrimination here, Your Honor, it's not unfair discrimination that would make the plan inappropriate. And there certainly is no violation of the absolute priority rule, because my client is the senior creditor, and we voluntarily subordinated any claim we had and said, look, we won't get paid at all until everybody else gets paid. We took no money as the shareholder of the debtor. We had made a post-petition loan to the debtor of $3 million, which we subordinated to everybody else's claim. So there's just no violation of the rule on absolute priority. That leaves Mr. Whitehurst's constitutional complaints. Let me touch on those briefly. The Seventh Amendment right to trial by jury, that's the Grand Financier case from the U.S. Supreme Court. Once his clients filed a proof of claim, they waived their right under the Seventh Amendment. His clients that did not file a proof of claim have no claim. They have no claim to which a Seventh Amendment jury trial right could attach now, because they, despite having gotten three notices, and they admit they got actual notice.
That does sound like a catch-22, doesn't it? The only way to get a jury trial in bankruptcy is to make a claim, and as soon as you make a claim, you can't get a jury trial.
Your Honor, that's the law, and I'm sticking to it. I think that's where we are.
That's your story.
That's my story, Your Honor. That's correct. But in any event, she certainly has no due process complaint. 237,000 satellite TV customers, 237,000. Each one of them got two individual notices before the bar date. The second individual notice, at the request of the creditors committee on which Mr. Whitehurst served, being paid by the debtor, the second notice included a simplified proof of claim form. Everybody got these two notices, and his clients admittedly received them. Then they get the third notice, which comes after the bar date, but the third notice was well before the plan was confirmed, so they still had time to come in and complain about the plan, even if they hadn't filed a proof of claim. Okay, so what does that leave us? If Your Honors were to say that the notice of appeal did not perfect jurisdiction from the confirmation order, if that's where you came down, you said it was not a ministerial remand, what would be left for Your Honors to deal with? Two orders. Those are the only two things I haven't touched on, the estimation order and the order sealing the matrix. So if I could touch on those very quickly. With respect to Mr. Whitehurst's complaint about the estimation order, again, the statutory standard is abuse of discretion on the judge's estimation. He holds a three-day evidentiary hearing. He concludes in his fact findings that $3,000 is the average amount that the customers borrowed, and so he estimates the claim at $3,000 plus this basket of benefits, which includes notice to the credit bureaus, payment of any tax consequences, and the right to opt out and have your claim fully paid, whatever amount you can prove up. Then there are two important points here. One is the one Judge Easterbrook touched on, which is their right to opt out and get paid whatever compensatory amount that they can prove up. The other important point with respect to the estimation order is that that was not the final amount that Class 8 got paid. The estimation order amount was superseded following a mediation in front of Judge Katz, where the debtor agreed and there was a upping of the amount to $5,500. So the estimation order that he's complaining about wasn't even the amount that his class ended up getting paid. Class 8 ended up getting paid $5,500 in cash and debt forgiveness instead of $3,000 plus the basket of benefits. So there's just no complaint here, and I really need to touch on the punitive damages point, because that's really where Mr. Whitehurst is on his complaint about the estimation order, that the judge decided to disallow punitive damages for purposes of estimation. That is completely within his discretion, Your Honors, under the Olympia equipment case with Judge Easterbrook on the panel. That's the case where...
You keep mentioning who the judges were.
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
It's completely irrelevant who wrote opinions of this court.
All right, Your Honor. Okay, that's fine.
Your opinions,
I hear you.
For the Court of Appeals.
All right. Well, this court decided in in Olympia Equipment that it was appropriate and proper for a bankruptcy judge to set punitive damages aside in the interest of getting full payment for all the creditors of the actual damage.
That wasn't a bankruptcy case, was it?
Olympia Equipment?
It was an antitrust case.
Your Honor, the point is...
The case that you're talking about was sort of an aside.
I'm with you. But the principle is, if you're trying to get full compensation of actual damages, which is where the bankruptcy judge was going here, that would be an appropriate thing to focus on. And as Mr. Whitehurst says in his brief, that's where the bankruptcy judge was going. He just thinks the bankruptcy judge didn't go far enough.
I must say, I don't understand that line of argument. Bankruptcy is supposed to vindicate rights under non-bankruptcy law.
Yes, Your Honor.
The first thing we need to determine is what the rights under non-bankruptcy law were.
Yes, Your Honor.
And then we will see what the relative entitlements of the people are.
And you asked...
If there is a right under non-bankruptcy law to punitive damages, then there is such a right.
And, Your Honor, you asked...
I don't see how a bankruptcy judge or a district court can say, we're going to cut off your rights under non-bankruptcy law in the interest... of what? Making our life a little simpler or ending this case a little sooner or something like that?
No, Your Honor, in the interest of getting the creditors paid at all.
But we need first to determine which of the creditors have which relative entitlements. If you have, say, $10 million in cash, we need to know whether one party's claim is a claim to $10 of that or is a claim to $1 million of that. The former if actual and the latter if punitive.
Right.
And only after we determine the party's relative claims can we figure out how they get carved up and written down.
Right. Your Honor, I agree with you completely. The problem here is the debtor...
But then you're in trouble, aren't
no,
you?
No, I don't... Because
the bankruptcy judge said, there are no punitive damages in my court. I don't like punitive damages in bankruptcy.
Well,
and
Your Honor...
that can't be...
Your Honor,
the law.
The debtor here didn't have $10 million. The debtor had virtually no money. The cash the debtor went into was...
That's a different line of argument, which is it doesn't make any difference whether punitive damages were awarded because there was nothing to pay out.
No, it's exactly on point, Your Honor, because the only way there was going to be money to pay out to the claimants at all is pursuant to the settlement with my client, AGFI. And under that settlement, AGFI had agreed to pay everybody all their compensatory, but had said, I'm not going to settle and I'm not going to do this deal if you expect me to pay punitives. So the bankruptcy judge is looking at a situation where if he accepts and approves the settlement, he has all the money he needs to pay compensatories, but he has no money for punitives, and if he doesn't go that route, there's no money for compensatories. That's the situation.
Mm-hmm.
So, see, it's really not...
No, look, the line of argument you're making is essentially that this plan could have been approved on a cram-down basis, on the line that these appellants got at least as much as they would have gotten under Chapter 7, because all the money is coming from your client. Now, that may be right. This may be an appropriate cram-down approval.
Mm-hmm.
That's not, however, the way the bankruptcy judge or the district judge looked at it. They both thought that they had a legal right just to move their pen and say, I don't believe in punitive damages in bankruptcy. And indeed, your brief attempted to defend that line.
Your Honor, that may be, I'm not disagreeing with what you're saying, other than to say it seemed to us, and it still seems to me, that it's appropriate for the bankruptcy judge to, without abusing his discretion, to accept the settlement and the plan that gives him all the money he needs for compensatories if he sets the punitive notion aside. And that's really where we are. I think that is what the bankruptcy judge was doing, but we feel that that's appropriate under the case law, Your Honor. My time's almost gone. There's only one other point that I wanted to touch upon, which is the doctrine of equitable mootness, which was removed from the Seventh Circuit lexicon by the UNR case. And we certainly recognize...
Judge Easterbrook.
Yes, sir, but I wasn't going to mention that. Yes, sir. while there is not a jurisdictional issue about equitable mootness, it still is considered as a point of equity. And we would point out here, Your Honor, that while you could possibly give relief to the appellant, you could undo the release, you could undo the injunction, you could let them come sue my client, there, it would be one-sided relief. There's no way to give relief here to the debtor who's now dissolved or to my client, AGFI, that's paid out $59 million that could never get back. And given the fact that the plan is fully consummated, and let me say that the only reason that my client paid out the funds is that that was a provision of the settlement that was insisted upon by the debtor. The debtor said, if the bankruptcy court and the district court don't stay, you will pay. And so that's the reason we paid. And having paid all the money and having really no practical way to recoup those funds, we feel like the full consummation of the plan is an equitable consideration that Your Honors can still take into account in deciding whether to unsettle this program. And if there are no other questions... Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ms. Yates. Anything further, Mr. Whitehurst?
As far as equitable mootness, she said that the debtor insisted upon the plan being funded if there were no stay. I don't think there's anything in the record on that. And, in fact, the record clearly shows that the American General was not called upon to fund the plan until all the appeals had been resolved on the confirmation. They did that voluntarily, essentially to try to raise the equitable mootness argument and defeat the appeal in this case. I want to go back briefly and talk about the punitive damages. Essentially, what we were talking about allowance doesn't necessarily get to where the claims are going to be paid in Section 726 of the Bankruptcy Code, although dealing with Chapter 7 cases, really establishes priorities that I think this court should take into consideration, given that this, even though it's a Chapter 11, is not really a reorganization, it's a liquidation. Those priorities require that all unsecured claims be paid, and then all late file claims be paid, and then punitive damages be paid. In other words, the Bankruptcy Code has a specific provision setting the priorities for punitive damages in Chapter 7 cases. And there really shouldn't be any reason this court shouldn't consider those priorities. I want to go back and talk about a couple things briefly on the estimation. I think the non-punitive damage part is also extremely important in looking at the estimation order. The bankruptcy judge said that in comparing the settlements to the status of our clients, said that our clients most closely resemble the Taylor Class B. Now the difference, that Taylor had two classes, Class A and Class B. Taylor Class A got $30,000. Taylor Class B got $3,000. The only difference between Taylor Class A and Taylor Class B was that Taylor Class B, the customers were in bankruptcy themselves, and the $3,000 was to be paid to the trustee. I cannot understand how our clients, if they were similar at all to any of the Taylor people, would be not more similar to the Class A Taylor group that was given $30,000. Also, he compared it to the Connor and the Byrd settlements, and Glenn Connor's group, they got paid $13,000. He said that they were more ready to go to trial, even though they filed their bankruptcy case like 34 days before, their lawsuit like 34 days before this thing was filed. And it just astounds me how the judge could make a distinction between those people and Class A. One other thing is in the Taylor Class B group, those people got $3,000 cash and they did not have to deduct what the balance was owed on the debt, which my client did, and she would have only gotten $1,000 if she had accepted the settlement. That's all I have. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. The case is taken under advisement.